try to reach him. So we are ready to get started, and I'll turn it over to the chair.
Good morning, everyone. Sorry for the technical difficulties, but I think once we've done this, we will be proficient at it next time. The date is March 16th, 2022, and the time is 9:16 a.m. And I'm calling to order the regular quarterly meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Property and Casualty Insurance Guarantee Association. This is a video conference meeting that's being conducted in accordance with Section 551.127 of the Texas Government Code. Currently, we have 8 board members and 1 industry vacancy, which the nominating committee is in the process of trying to fill with a replacement. Currently, we have 7 of the 8 board members in attendance and on video. Mike Garrick is still trying to call in, and we will announce when he joins the meeting. So we do have a quorum present. TP SIGA staff in attendance is Marvin Kelly, John D'Amato, Annette Evans, and Stephanie Mendoza. We are also joined by TP SIGA's outside counsel, Shelby Betts. And since I was working on the technical difficulties, I wasn't 100% sure who was here from TDI. I know that we may not be having a lot of interaction with them, but just for the record, we've got Caitlin Merrick, Ryan Rewe, and Tina Arendahl from TDI that have also joined us today.
We also have the replacement for John Alexander Van Hugo. He's on the online as well.
Okay, I didn't see you. Welcome.
Thank you.
He's under the name Tina Arendahl, but that's not Tina.
Okay, so Tina's not here.
I didn't get the Zoom mail.
I'm using
Tina's link.
Video.
All right. Well, thanks so much and welcome. At this time, it's also a good time. I know Marvin briefly introduced him, to welcome our 2 new board members, Steve Flynn and Steve Holt. So we're going to have the battling Steves like we used to have the battling Mikes. And we want to welcome them to their first official board meeting. I got to know them a little bit when they attended the updated board training earlier this month. And I want to thank Commissioner Brown and TDI for finding 2 individuals I really think are going to be a valuable asset to the board and a pleasure to work with. Really great personalities. I'd like to give them both an opportunity just for a brief introduction because they both have some interesting backgrounds. How about Steve Flynn? You go first.
Well, good morning. Good morning, all. It's great to be with you. My name is, as we said before, Steve Flynn. I have been in the 5th year of an epic failed retirement. That's what my wife calls it anyway. I spent 35 years with General Motors in the corporate world, and since then have really turned my passion to mediation. So I'm really, really doing a lot of mediation, both as pro bono with the court systems and on my own. I'm finishing up my master's degree in May in dispute resolution and looking forward to working with the board here. And also coming off serving as the MUD board president, which is Municipal Utility District up here in Trophy Club, which is outside of Dallas. So great being with you.
Thanks. And Steve Holt, why don't you introduce yourself?
Absolutely. Thank you for allowing me to be here today, and I look forward to serving this board. Steve Holt here. Have a story about that in regard to the Steves, but I'll save that for later. I am a banker by trade. I've been in banking since I was 16 years old. I celebrate my 50th year in banking this year. I've served as president and CEO of 2 other banks. I'm currently working with a bank as a CFO in an interim position while they attempt to find a permanent replacement for that. I, too, serve the public as a city council person for the city of Runaway Bank. Everybody's going, where is that? Well, we're on Lake Bridgeport, which is about 20 miles to the west of Decatur. Everybody knows where Decatur is. So I'm looking forward to this opportunity to serve and to meet new individuals and to enhance my professional life.
Well, thanks. And again, welcome to you both. I'd like to move on now to the antitrust admonition. I'd like to remind everybody to keep in mind that Members of the board are competitors in the marketplace, and therefore we must all exercise care in avoiding any discussions that might give rise to an allegation of a violation of state or federal antitrust laws. So please speak up if you have any concerns in that regard. Next, we will move on to item number two, and I would like to entertain a motion to approve the summary of the official minutes of the December 8th, 2021 regular meeting of the Board of Directors.
This is Tiffany. I move.
Is there a second?
I'll second it. This is David.
Second is by David Nardecchia. Is there any discussion, any questions? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Or is anyone opposed or wants to abstain? Hearing none, then the motion passes unanimously. So the executive director, the chief financial officer, and our outside counsel met with TDI prior to this meeting, and they were informed that TDI does not have any new information to provide regarding potential insolvency, which is good news. Therefore, we do not have a need to go into the executive session to consider the TDI Office of Supervisory Intervention Oversight Report. And we will move on to agenda item number four. And that's the executive director's remarks and overview of the meeting.
Okay. If you'll just take a look at your agenda packet, I'll just do a walkthrough of who's going to be doing the presentations and the staff person that will be supporting them through this entire process. The first thing on the agenda is the nominating committee. And the chair of the nominating committee is Mike Garrick, who's still attempting to get onto the phone, so we'll probably go past that for a while. But just for the benefit of the new members, we had an insurance company member that resigned from the board as a result of the financial requirements. And the way that it works is, the remaining insurance company members select another name and they put forward. And once they do that, the full board votes on it, then it's sent to the insurance commissioner. And the insurance commissioner has the final say as to whether to approve a board member or not. If you have the same thing with the public members, it's now legislation change and the insurance commissioner selects all the public members. So that's just some background and reference to that. After Mike gives us an update on that process, it'll move to the ad hoc corporate governance committee. And that'll be our chair, Joe Betsy Norton. And just again, just for background purposes, all the guarantee funds received a letter from the Department of Insurance concerning governance. And it had some recommendations for how to improve governance. And I think that's what the chair will be addressing, some of the things we've done to comply with that particular requirement. After she finishes her particular areas, and just I'll mention that one of the favorite things for her, appointment of new committee members. So you'll have the opportunity to be selected for a committee, and that's extra pay as well. we move on from there to the claims committee. And if you'll turn in your packet under the tab claims committee, I don't know how many have had an opportunity to read the board report that was submitted, but it had all the claims information in it. Our chair of the claims committee is Mark Tasui, and he'll be assisted by the claims director, Annette Evans. And it's a recap of where we are with claims, where they're at, and how they're being processed. Following the claims committee, that'll move on to the HR committee. And with the HR committee, Mike Wilson was the chair of that committee. His term expired and he didn't renew for another year as a result of some health issues he was having. So with that, the chair, Joe Betsy Norton, she's the interim chair of that particular committee and she'll be handling that portion of the presentation. That'll be followed by finance and audit. And if you look in your agenda packet, there's a complete listing in the agenda packet are the minutes from the meetings that we have with the committees, the subcommittees, prior to having our full board meeting. So any specific information concerning that is in that particular. Our chair of the Finance and Audit Committee is Tiffany Reiner, and she'll be assisted by staff member CFO John D'Amato. After the completion of that, We go into our executive session where you have an opportunity to ask the general counsel any questions you have concerning Texas Open Meetings Act. There's a litigation report if we have any litigation and other confidential personnel matters. So with that, I'll turn it back. I would be turning it back to the chair of the nominating committee, but since that person is not online yet, I'll just switch it up to our chair, Joe Betsy Norton.
Okay, hold on.
I assume, Joe Betsy, that since if Mike's not on, you can either, you know, take the nominating committee out of turn, or perhaps you or Stephanie can give the report.
Well, yeah, I'm going to continue to have Stephanie to try to.
Hey, would you just tell them I'm having trouble with this computer? It won't, I can't get rid of the screen that's in front of Zoom to turn off the microphone. So if they could just hold on 1 minute and I'll just try to resolve it as soon as I can.
We'll just pause.
Yeah, tell them just to pause for 1 second while I try to get it back to the Zoom screen.
Right, I just got a message from Joe Betsy. She's can't move the screen to her satisfaction, so we're going to pause for a bit. And I don't know if there's a update on Mike's ability to.
Okay, sorry about that. I had it wouldn't let me get back to the Zoom screen. It had blocked me out. So okay. I was able to follow along. The nominating committee, I did talk to Mike about this, and he's been working hard trying to recruit an industry member. And we have run into several challenges with the personal financial statement requirement, which I guess was little known before, but now is out there in the industry. I think he's got a good candidate that he's pursuing in hopes to nail down and get to the TDI in time for the June meeting. So that's really what he, I think the update he would have provided there, that it's the stay tuned for something hopefully at the June meeting. Next, we'll move on to item number 6, the Ad Hoc Corporate Governance Committee and the appointment of new committee members. I did get a chance to talk to everyone on the board about their preferences, their strengths, and I'm happy to report that. I think we've got a pretty good slate for all of the committees. And I've emailed them the committee assignments. Marvin, I will shoot that to you here in a minute, but I don't want to mess up my screen again and have more technical difficulties. So the executive committee, which includes TP SIGA's officers, which I'm the chair, Mike Garrick's vice chair, Tiffany Reiner serves as secretary treasurer, and David Nardecchia is the new parliamentarian who replaced Mike Wilson, who left the board. The executive committee is going to handle the issues that were previously assigned to the Ad Hoc Corporate Governance Committee and the Legislative Task Force, in addition to any other, you know, miscellaneous issues that that we would take up in due course. The Claims and Legal Committee, Mark T. will continue as chair of that committee, and he'll be joined by our new board members, Steve Flynn and Steve Holt. I think since TP SIGA's primary responsibility is the payment of claims for insolvent insurers, I think this assignment will help to round out their new board training. And really learn the ins and outs of what TP SIGA is all about. The Finance and Audit Committee, Tiffany Reiner will continue as chair, and she will be joined by Steve Flynn, David Nardecchia, and back up. She'll be joined by Larry Bruning, Mike Garrick, and Steve Holt. I think Steve Holt's banking and accounting background is gonna be a real asset to that committee. The Human Resources Committee, I'm going to continue serving as chair of that committee, and will be joined by Steve Flynn, David Nardecchia, and Tiffany Reiner. And the Nominating Committee, Mike Garrick will continue to chair the committee and will be joined by Tiffany Reiner and Mark T. Are there any questions regarding committee assignments? All right, then we will move on to the report on updating of the board training. And I'll let Shelby Betts, who is our outside general counsel, who worked with staff in updating the board training, let her just tell you a little bit about what all that included.
Joe Betsy, this is Mike, I'm on.
Thank you, okay. Mike Garrick has joined us about 9:31. Thanks so much, Mike.
Sorry about all that.
All right, well, as was briefly mentioned earlier, all of the boards that are appointed by the commissioner got not so long ago a letter exhorting all boards to adhere to good corporate governance practices. And a couple of the things that the letter called out was try to enhance board training, especially with regard to fiduciary duties and their ability to access legal counsel during their board service. And so we took a look at our historical board training, which in my opinion has always been very good and comprehensive, but augmented that with additional material to specifically hone in on fiduciary duties that are applicable to our board members, as well as their ability to access legal counsel from myself and from the on-site attorney at TPC, Amber Walker. In addition, the staff, Marvin, John, and Annette, did a great job in updating the rest of the historical training to give a lot of real life practical advice with regard to situations that the board encounters on a pretty routine basis. So I think we've done a good job on addressing the main, some at least most of the things mentioned in that letter. And we'll see, we had two guinea pigs, I guess, our two new Steves, and hopefully it went pretty well. But if either of them have any suggestions for future training, they should pass those along to management and me. We'll try to continuously improve the training.
Okay, thanks, Shelby. Item number three, there is the review of the board book format. This is just an ongoing corporate governance improvement. The executive committee is going to work with Shelby and TP Sega staff just to update the content and format of the board books going forward. It will not be a light switch. It'll be just a work in progress, just to make sure that we're teeing up all the issues so the board members can easily tell what are going to be action items, what the important things are, and maybe some of the historical documents can be saved to the SharePoint. And I do want to invite all board members, if they have any thoughts on how to improve them, just to please send them to me or to the executive committee. The next item is number 7, the claims committee, and we'll call on Mark T to lead that discussion.
All right, good morning, everyone. And I'm excited about having Steve 1 and Steve 2 join the claims committee. And so for their benefit, I'd just like to say that last year was a very busy year for TP SIGA. We had multiple new insolvencies. We actually started January of 2021 with just about 2,200 claims pending. And by the second and third quarter, we spiked up to 10,000 pending claims with the multiple insolvencies, ACC being the biggest one. In the fourth quarter, we did have a couple new ones, but luckily those were lower volume insolvencies. So we've been continuing to trend down with our claims pending volume. So with that, I'll give a chance for Annette to give a fourth quarter update and also an update on the current pending insolvencies.
Thanks, Mark. This is Annette Evans, claims director. Like Mark said, we started out with about 2,200 claims and spiked up because we had a total of 8 insolvencies in 2021 and have already had our first one for 2022. Good news on that, though, we continue to show a decrease in open claims. This quarter was about 14% decrease. So we're sitting now at 7,800, a little bit over 7,800 at the end of the quarter, and continued to spike down. We had about 7,500 at the end of January. So we're continuing to spike down, and we'll start stepping down on some of the contractors that we're using to handle this. Litigation count, however, is on the increase. We increased 3.4% this quarter. We're at 2,540 now. Most of these, about 2,300 of them, was from one estate. We continue to get new litigation on ACCC even today. And they've been in liquidation the last part of December. So we started with 249 claims in litigation at the beginning of the year, and now we're at over 2,500. UEP, the unearned premium count, it cut in half, about 600 to 300. We're still expecting around 1,000 from Windhaven National, so we're expecting some more to come in on those. This department also collects net worth, deductible subrogation, that type of thing. We collected $546,000 this quarter and ended the year at $1,741,000. We also are responsible for cost containment. We have medical billings of over $6.4 million, but thanks to the work of our cost containment department, we're able to save about 76% of that, paying only $1.8 million in the fourth quarter. Save a total of 73% for the year, so they do a good work there. And as I mentioned before, I had 8 insolvencies in 2021. The first one was Houston General Exchange. They liquidated actually in 2020 in August, but we didn't start getting the claims until 2021. Ended up with over 1,200, but we're down to 146 of those now. None of those were litigation files, so we have very few, if any, lit files on HGIE. They were under stop work order for various reasons. They have since picked back up to start to send us things. I think what's pending now is unearned premium claims. They think it may be about 100, but they're not sure. So we're starting to work back with the SDR to get some whatever work they have left for us on HIE so we can wrap that up. The second insolvency that came in for 2021 was ACCC. Ended up almost at 9,000 claims there. We got 5,500 pending. This is a fast moving estate. We've already paid all of the UEP claims and POC processes have already started with the SDR. Both of those were non-standard auto. We about March and April, we start getting different types of insolvency. So this year, they're kind of all over the board, auto. We've gotten this Bedivere, which is liquidated in March of 2020, one, which was environmental claims. So had silica, some pollution type claims, and some workers' comp. We only got about 138, had 64 pending. Most of the environmental claims we were able to close due to a net worth statute, a net worth exclusion in the Guarantee Act. So most of those insurers were worth over $50 million. Then we got AMCAP in April of that year, last year. They were a commercial residential property for multifamily dwellings and homeowners associations. So condos, apartment buildings, that type of thing. We got not a lot of claims, but each claim was counted like 3 or 4 times. Some had as many as 125 buildings that were insured under the policy. Each policy was insured on a per building basis. So that one is still ongoing and has presented some unique challenges, but we're finally being handled, finally seeing them being paid. So expect that one will be resolving. Then in July, we got Gulfstream, which was just a single homeowner's condos, renter's type insurance. We only got 16 of those claims in the process of getting those handled. Shortly after, the next month in August, we got Western General Insurance, again, a non-standard auto. We didn't get many claims, like Mark said. These were all not Texas insured, so they didn't have very many auto claims pending. They did have 711 unearned premium claims, but they've all been paid. Well, half of them were regular policies, the other half is gap coverage, which we reviewed, got a legal opinion, and concluded that it was not covered under the Guarantee Act. So we turned that back over to the receiver. And then we got a couple months later, we got Global Liberty Insurance, a non-standard commercial auto. We didn't get very many claims on their five, so that one's being handled. Even though that liquidation was October of 2021, we just got the documents necessary to handle them yesterday. So that one's kind of slow moving. One of these claims is already in litigation. It was in litigation before we received it, so we're handling that. We got notice in late October of Highlands Insurance, and this one was one that was in rehab since 2003, then was put into receivership in October 29th, and that one was a workers' comp and pollution environmental type policies. Also, workers' comp policies were mostly sold off to Sedgwick Insurance, so we haven't gotten any of those, although there may be some excess workers' comp coming to us that a different managing general agent was handling for them. We've still yet to see those. If we get some, it will be relatively minor amount. We did receive some environmental claims, and likely all of them will be closed due to the network exclusion as well. And then, we thought we'd rest a little while, but first of January, we got Access Home Insurance, which is a residential, sold residential policies. Luckily, Safe, that's Access Home is a company out of Louisiana. So we didn't get very many of those. We got 21 claims, and they found another company to buy all of the active policies. So we shouldn't have a big unearned premium claims on those. That's about all that's happened. We don't usually get very many complaints through the Texas Department of Insurance, but we did get a few on, we have that through on MCAT. Those claims in the end, they come with, I've seen as much as 4,000 pieces of data being sent to us to evaluate on each claim. So they're taking a lot of time to handle. We've got processes set up and vendors set up to help us through that process. I think we've got it about done. All of those complaints have been answered and paid, by the way. So it's moving forward. Any questions? That's all we've been doing this year. Claim. We haven't been doing much. But any questions on either claims in general or on any of the individual estates that I can answer? Mark?
And Ed?
Uh-huh.
I think the board may be interested to know about the resolution of the $500,000 loan that was made to the estate of HGIE. And the good news, cutting to the chase, is that the TDI, the SDR, was able to settle its issues with the former accountants of HGIE, obtain a settlement, the amount of which was large enough to enable our $500,000 loan with interest to be repaid. And I think John D'Amato has already gotten the wire and it's in the bank.
It is in the bank. Yes, yes, indeed.
And just to add on to what Shelby indicated concerning that, HGIE was insolvent and they were not able to get the information to us for 6 months, about 5 or 6 months. And they were running out of money. The company was totally broke. The Department of Insurance asked the board if they would consider giving a loan of $500,000 so that they could pursue, actually continue operating, paying for the special deputy receiver to handle processing or getting the claims to us so that we could actually pay the claims. Well, they went forward. They continued to operate and they just got us the information, I think in the last few months, from HGIE. So now we can handle the claims. But most companies that we get in now are out of state companies. They're not Texas-based companies. And when they come into the guarantee fund system, they're broke. These non-standard auto companies don't have any money whatsoever. In the past, we've had insolvencies and they've had estate assets. And the special deputy receiver's responsibility is to collect those assets from the insolvent company. And then we're the largest creditor to each and every insolvency because we immediately start paying claims. So this one, the HGIE was very unusual. And I wanted to point out the AMCAP has been, I don't think she's really explained the extent of issues with that. But as a result of Snowmageddon, that housing complex went down. And somebody wrote a policy that was just very favorable. It had a $5,000 deductible for all these buildings, not per building, just one $5,000 deductible. And they were calling everybody. I think our board member, Mike Garrett, got a couple calls from different people. They were calling it all over trying to get these things resolved because they paid all their vendors. And if they could not get paid by us, they were going to be out of business. So they called. I asked Mike specifically just to kind of refer him. I don't know how they got his name, but they did. And I asked him to refer him back to our system because of the amount, the administrative work that was being done to bring this to closure. So, all right, thank you.
All right, thanks, Annette. Joe Betsy, that's all we have from the Claims Committee.
Okay, thanks for the update. And y'all may have noticed I was without power for a few minutes, and you'll be glad to know that TP-SIGA does have some efficiency things in place because I've been very still in the conference room out here at headquarters. The lights went off. The next item, I was going to also add, and I should have mentioned this back before we move on to the human resources, when we were talking about just some of the challenges in getting another industry board member, just because of the personal financial statement requirements. I did want to let y'all know that TDI last month had solicited all stakeholders to submit any kind of legislative recommendations by March 11th for the next session that they can start reviewing. I went ahead and submitted one on our behalf, just saying that we would like to remove that requirement of the personal financial statement because it really doesn't add any value, and to substitute, if necessary, maybe just an annual conflict of interest or qualification for office that we could file with TDI. I don't necessarily expect TDI to make that a formal recommendation to the legislature, although it'd be great if they did, but wanted to get that on their radar officially. And, you know, I also indicated it'd probably be appropriate for all of the guarantee associations because we're all in the same boat. So my apologies for not mentioning that earlier. Item number 8, the Human Resources Committee. I'd like to talk about the first two items together. The board included a 3.1% merit pool in the budget that we approved in December, but we did not have a separate vote on approving the merit pool. And so every year the board approves the merit pool and then a salary grid shift percentage that doesn't affect the budget. It's merely moving the minimum and maximums, I guess, and the midpoints up. And usually that grid shift slightly lags behind the merit pool number. And that's just so that people that are getting the merit increases don't max out of their pay grade where they might not be eligible for additional raises. And so it's really necessary to stay in step with market conditions and ensure that the high performing employees, you know, don't max out prematurely. So after reviewing, you know, industry composites and talking with industry members of the board, the recommendation is to approve the 3.1% merit pool and a 2.5% salary grid shift. And I'd like to, if somebody could make a motion in that regard, I would appreciate
Mike
it.
Mike Garrick, so move.
So Mike Garrick makes the motion. Is there a second?
Tiffany Reiner, I second it.
So Tiffany seconds the motion. Is there any discussion or questions? I'll just indicate one more piece of discussion around this. I know that there had been a lot of floating proposals on compensation or other employee benefits, and that doesn't take them off the table permanently. We just wanted to make sure that we could take this action right now and look at the others in due course, as you'll hear about in a few minutes. So if there aren't any questions, then I would ask that all in favor say aye.
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 Is there any opposition or abstention? Hearing none, then the motion carries unanimously. Item three is proposed changes regarding employee cost sharing with respect to group health insurance premiums. And so I'm advised that staff will be receiving quotes for the health insurance premiums in the next month or so for the July renewal, and that maybe they have a new broker at this time. And so the Human Resources Committee will be discussing what, if any, changes should be made to this employee cost sharing after receiving that information and options regarding the new quote and a history of the changes in premium sharing, coverages, and copays over the last 5 years. So that's a stay tuned, and hopefully we'll have something that we can discuss at the June meeting. Are there any questions on that item? All right, then next is the work from home policy. At our September 15th, 2020 board meeting, the board approved a new telecommuting policy, which was initially drafted to address remote work during the pandemic, but the policy was revised to include remote work opportunities outside of the pandemic on a case-by-case basis, depending on TPSIGA's business needs, the individual position duties, and other factors. So I think most of us on the call, especially those in the industry, have learned how important remote work is for many employees, sometimes more important than compensation and other things, because they got used to it during the pandemic, and I think many performed well. And I wanted to give Marvin or John an opportunity to update the board on TPSIGA's plans, and, you know, short-term and long-term, and to see if there are any issues that need to be addressed by the Human Resources Committee.
I'll start it off and then I'll kick it to John in reference to it. And I indicated this during our training. I think the new focus for all businesses are going to be maintaining flexibility. And hybrid is the future of how these businesses are going to operate. And I think we're in line with that future. The issue for me is how you continue to engage employees when they're not in the office. And that's something that's going to be left to the individuals that are here to address that situation. But I think everybody is facing that same situation. Hybrid operation is just how we're going to operate in the future. I don't think we'll ever come back to being in an office with everybody being here. And John can kind of talk to you about the specifics of the policy or if any recommended changes. John?
Yes, so the work at home policy in and of itself, and the as-needed component of it is gone full force. Employees certainly are thrilled by that option, as well as going back to the flexible work schedule with regard to hours of work. They are considered on a case-by-case basis, certainly, as far as job duties and requirements. We have 41 FTEs, as you know, and on average in the office, we've got about 18 folks in the office on a daily basis. And a lot of that has to do with coverage in various areas. We always have someone, there's always someone here from IT, there's always someone here from finance on all the 5 days of the week. Clearly, in the claim function, I'll let Annette speak to those as well. And it's working well. The I'll toss it over to Annette in a second, but just to kind of add to that, we have 30,000 square feet here of space. We've looked at options to potentially sublet some space, get out of our lease, working with our broker. Pre-pandemic, there would have been no problem doing such, but it's kind of a no-go. So we are on the hook here until November of 24, but certainly given our space needs, given the fact that contractors are all remote, given the fact that we do have the work from home initiatives, we're gonna be looking certainly for a smaller type space. Presently we're spending $65,000 a month for rent. So, you know, we anticipate being able to reduce that expense. But again, that would be expiring November 24. But as far as claim, do you want to talk to how work from home is there?
So it's the same in claims. It's on a job specific basis. And so we have most of the administrative staff here every day, you know, mailroom, handling checks, customer service, that reception. Those compositions are part of the 18 that's here every day. And then we have the supervisors coming in for that leadership presence on a rotating basis. So they take the month and make sure that somebody's here every day. So the staff that is in the office has some, you know, see the leadership is here and ready for any help that they may need. The adjusters at this time, the few that we have on staff are working from home. And it's working well. Like I said, it's on an as-needed basis. It's, you know, job-specific and performance-specific as well. So if there's a need to bring them in because we see an issue with performance, they are well aware that, that's a possibility.
Just to add to that, one of the things they've done already, and it's a credit to management, basically, not me, them, is they had some management training, and we brought all the employees back in for the training, had an outside person come in to provide the training for our employees. And I think that's the way everybody needs to look at this, is you still need to engage your employees and bring them in. A good part of the culture we've developed here and the longevity of the organization is based on the fact that people were here and interacting, and now you have to look at a different way of addressing.
A question, this is Mike Garrett, a couple of questions. First one, Marvin, I appreciate what you're saying about making sure people are engaged and making sure, since they're remotely, that they're still supervised as they were when they were in the office. Unfortunately, speaking from my company's perspective, we didn't have any whole lot of experience at that. And I suspect that's going to be the case with you guys as well. You might consider reaching out to maybe a consultant to help with those tools and things that you could be doing to make sure that you are managing them effectively, because it's a new way of thinking, especially from a workforce that's been in the office all the time and limited, you know, remote work. So that's just a comment, not really a question, something for y'all to maybe consider. And secondly, ICT has sold their building, and so they're in a process of going to be looking for space as well. Timing may not work, but Marvin, it might be worth the call to Albert to see if, you know, maybe, you know, if you go lease a space because you need a smaller footprint, maybe there's some ways to work that out together and get a better deal. Just a thought.
Okay. I'll give him a call. I'm going to ask him for a discount too, Mike. So you know.
We could sublet space today.
Yeah, or maybe there's some way that we can, you know, because they're going through the exact same thing you're going through.
Yeah.
Most of their folks are going to be remote. So their footprint, obviously, they had a great opportunity to sell a building. So it worked out really well. But they're still going to need some space.
Yeah. I'll talk to Albert, and then I have John talk with our broker, because they're always looking at options, too. And if we can give them somebody that's a possibility, probably right. Helpful to us.
Yeah, it might work, even with, like I say, timing may not work, but you never know.
Hey, Marvin.
Yes.
This is Steve Flynn. To piggyback on what Mike has said, you know, almost all of these, all companies, if not every company, is looking at, you know, the new world order and how to address remote workers, all this stuff. So my question is, from an HR standpoint, and we're only an hour into the broadcast, this might be my first ignorant question, so somebody keep note of that. But has there been thought to changing or addressing job descriptions to address this new way of working? Yep. And I guess the second part of that is, on the other end, looking at performance, expectations, evaluations, maybe all of that needs to be looked at together as you start to address this new way of doing business.
Yeah, and thanks for the setup question. We've actually already started that. We're reviewing the job descriptions as we speak because we're going through the evaluation process for our employees right now. Mm-hmm. And as a result of this new hybrid operation and some of the changes to the structure internally, like for example, you know, HR, John is handling human resources now, and planning and business services, because we had staff before that handled that. And with transitioning the organization, a lot of those responsibilities moved over there. So that's happening as we speak. Something has already been sent out with job descriptions, asking people for input in reference to what people are actually doing now and how they're actually operating. So no, that wasn't an ignorant question. That was a very good question. John?
And I just want to add to that too. We've talked about the marketplace with regard to jobs, and we have had some folks leaving the association either for retirement or going to other companies. And that's really forced us to be on the ready with regard to job descriptions if we need to go out to the marketplace. And, you know, more times than not, folks who've been in a position forever and ever and ever, position descriptions are not updated as they should be. And suddenly we go out to the marketplace and we're like, that's not what Sally Sue does. And we need to be on the ready in that way. I know that Annette has had a few folks either through retirement or leaving the company where we had to go through that exercise.
This is Mike Garrick. John, you said something I wasn't aware of. Can you quantify what we've lost to other companies? Not retirements, but to other companies.
I can certainly speak to that. We actually did lose a senior workers comp adjuster to a local company here, and they received a sizable raise and bonus in doing such. There's certainly that risk there that's taking place for us. And again, we just need to be on the ready. We also, you know, some of the intel that we've gotten with regard to some of our positions, they are, as an example, a customer service rep is earning, you know, $18 an hour here at TP Siga, but that same competitive firm is paying $25 an hour. So, you know, it's a tough market for us.
Yeah, and this is Mike Garrick again, and I agree, but losing one is not, you know, I'm not sure it sends off an alarm quite yet. And I think we have to be very careful when we lose talent to for-profit companies. To me, that's a different type of an employee that's going to a for-profit company. And we're not for-profit. We're more of an administrative type deal. And unfortunately, that pay scale is going to be a little bit different than a for-profit. Yeah. And they can use capital and resources to get whatever talent they so desire.
Sure.
But we're not in that position. So sure. I guess, and I don't know where this is going. It alarmed me when you said it, but when we only had one, I guess I'm not near as alarmed. Because I know there's discussion and will be on the table of some type of one-time increase. Doesn't appear that we're in a position to do anything like that, but that's just my initial thoughts.
Yeah. And Mike, I'll say this in reference to that. We have such longevity here with our employment base. You know, the person that left had 25 years, and actually they came in before they left and said, hey, you know, I'm going to this other company, I'd like to stay. Can you kind of match or meet it? And, you know, we couldn't. And actually, I encourage people to go when they have better opportunities. It's just part of the process. But I think we have positions here that are comparable to the industry, just like we'd be up a creek if we lost our IT person who's been here for 29 years. He's one of my originals. But he could make more in the market. I think the fact that we've had the type of environment and the culture and the celebrations that we do have kept people here over a long period of time. Our longevity was 18 years, but with these new staff members, it dropped down to 14 years. So I blame them for the lack of longevity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Marvin, I would comment though that really that trend of people staying at companies for 30, 40 years or their entire career really is unheard of nowadays out in the marketplace. But you mentioned you'd be up a creek if you lost your IT person. I mean, you should have succession plans in place so that we don't miss a beat should that IT person decide tomorrow to retire or, you know, to use the old saying, wins the lottery or whatever may happen. We should not be in any conundrum where when somebody retires or leaves the company for any reason, we're in trouble. So I would encourage you to, you know, make sure there's a succession plan in place for any of these key positions. And, you know, I thought we had that pretty well settled a year or so ago. But I would, again, encourage you, especially in today's marketplace, where the norm is not to stay at a company for a long period of time, to, you know, continue to do that.
Yeah. And I'll say we have a succession plan, which I presented to the board the last 3 or 4 years, which resulted in us being able to hire Annette and hire John. That was part of the succession plan. The longevity for the organization, Jesse was here 26 years, our old claims director, and Brent Jones was here for 26 years. So we've had, even though you said that's kind of old, that's been our norm for this organization, is longevity. So we do have a succession plan. What I'm indicating is just that this person's been here 29 years. He was one of my original hires, and he stayed here. He just has superior talents. And somebody would want to get this person, it would be very difficult to replace that type of experience and talent at the price that we're paying at this point. So I just point that out.
Yeah. If I can just add a comment there, Tiffany, I certainly do not disagree with you with regard to succession planning, but remember, we're an organization of 41 people. Each department is very, very thin. The IT department reports into me. We are a department of 4 individuals, and we don't have a possibility of a succession plan internally. So our succession plan for the IT manager is to recruit from the outside. There's no other alternative there. We lost a network administrator that went off to a consulting firm within the last year. We were extremely, extremely fortunate to hire an individual who used to be the director of IT for Georgetown Independent School District. He retired, and much like Steve Flynn, failed at retirement and wanted to keep working. And he was willing to come on board for clearly a salary that is well below what he was earning before. So we got lucky. But honestly, when Gary decides to move on over the next, you know, couple of years or so, our only solution is to recruit from the outside. And that's where we're at.
But to Tiffany's point, this is Mike Garrick. I mean, that may be what we need to do. And I'm with you there. But there's a difference between that IT job for the guy willing to come to Tepasiga because of his situation and being retired versus maybe the job that he had. They're not equivalent. I mean, we're not that big and you're not going to get, you know, the top IT person to come to this organization. We're going to just realize we have to settle for what you just described. Someone that maybe has retired that wants to work a few more years, has the knowledge, but understands the pay and the benefits and everything is not going to be like what they had. And, you know, that's okay. I mean, I don't see any issue with that. But I think sometimes we're butting heads with you guys about comparing that Tepasiga job to something equivalent in the industry. And I don't think they're equivalent. And Marvin, you and I've had this discussion before ever since I've been on the board. I don't believe those jobs are equivalent to industry jobs for a for-profit company. I just don't. And, you know, some of the other industry people may disagree with me, but that's just where I'm at.
Mike, I wholeheartedly agree with you. I think that there are a lot of benefits of working for a smaller organization that you simply don't get in a larger organization. You know, one of which is stress level. You know, it's simply not the same. So I don't think that we can compare the jobs and the pay scales at TP SIGA to those of a for-profit larger organization.
Yeah. I would say, yeah, it doesn't sound like there's a trend right now. And I think TP SIGA has been lucky because of the environment and the retention of talent. But I think we do have to keep a close eye on it, because I think employees across the board in every industry are struggling with retention and turnover. So I think we're lucky that TP SIGA hasn't seen that. But I don't think that means we need to keep a status quo. I think we need to keep a close eye on it. And if there's, you know, a reason to kind of shift and kind of take a look at what the pool looks like and the compensation, I think we have to be open to it. But I agree, right now it doesn't seem like a trend, but I think it's something we need to keep an eye on.
And I just wanted to maybe correct something. I'm not sure. We've had one leave for higher salary and claims lately. And had trouble hiring maybe three more because of salary. But we also lost one in accounting and one in IT for the same reason. So it wasn't one.
That's right.
It was actually three. But I take your point.
And I realize people are going to leave an organization. They leave every day. But one, two, three, you know, from different areas or even from the same area, to me is not alarming given what's happening right now in the marketplace. I mean, there's companies where they're losing 20, 25, 30% of their staff, you know, to other positions and other organizations. You have a lot of people who are job hopping right now, trying to find out what else is out there, you know, get different benefits. They might, I think to Joe Betsy's point earlier, the flexible work life, that to me, I turned a job down recently because I wasn't going to have the flexibility that I have in my current role. And, you know, hey, the pay was better, benefits were better, everything, but I could not give up that flexibility. And I think that is an area internally to TP SIGA that we can continue to evolve with and use that as a promotion to bring employees into the organization.
And I agree. I think everybody's dealing with the great resignation, which is going on throughout the country. We just need to be aware of it and act accordingly. So I think us working, just making you aware of here's our situation and here's what's going on here, and having recommendations for addressing that in the future is the way that we'll go.
Okay. Well, thank you. I think that was a good, robust discussion. And I mean, I think we have some different opinions, but I do think the board, you know, wants to ensure that TP SIGA, bottom line, has the ability to attract and retain qualified people. I think there are several tools, several things we could discuss in the HR committee about how we might approach this from just some long-term planning. So we'll look forward to continuing this discussion in June. We've been going at this about an hour. Is everyone okay? We really only have one more section, which is the Finance and Audit Committee. But if y'all would like to take a break now, I was gonna take a 10-minute break between the Finance and Audit Committee and the board and council only executive session. But please let me know if somebody thinks we need to go ahead and take the break now. All right. Then we will move on to item number 9, which is the Finance and Audit Committee. And Tiffany Reiner, the chair, will lead that discussion.
All right. So I'll direct you to the board book to Exhibit A. This is the Information Technology Enhancement Update. We had three security improvements over the past quarter. The first one being that we did upgrade our check printing application. So we have moved over to Microsoft Edge. We were previously on Internet Explorer. This does include, when you go over to Edge, the smart screen, which defends against more phishing attempts. So that is complete and up and running. We also are going with an updated 2022 version of security awareness. So this is through NOBE4. We will be launching this, and it really will more of a training, I guess I would say, with all of our employees. We've been doing for the new board members periodic phishing attempts on employees and training there. And, you know, John has reported back, you know, multiple times that employees do very well with those. So this year we're continuing forward with that, but we do have an updated version that is going out. And then the last thing is our pay stubs have been migrated to electronic. So they were still in the old fashioned paper form. We have now gone to an electronic version there. So any questions on the ongoing security improvements? And just so you know, we had a couple of years ago, a comprehensive security plan with honestly more things on there than I could count. But every quarter we do approximately 3 to 4 security improvements. So I did want to circle back on one thing here is there was a question at our committee meeting regarding the cyber insurance. And just because we did just do, we're doing some additional training there. I did a little bit of research. We had a large increase on our cyber liability premium this year that we buy on behalf of the organization. And there was just some concern over that increase and how much it was. But I did find out from the industry, the average increase without a claim was 38%.
What?
Yeah. So just knowing that the average, you know, increase there is that significant, and we have had a claim, our organization did back in 2020. So knowing that, I feel pretty good that we came out okay in our increase this year. So, moving on to our auto assessment status. So back in the third quarter of 2021, at that board meeting, we did decide that we needed to assess the industry. We don't take assessments lightly. I think since I have been on the board, which has been quite a while now, we have done 2 assessments, but prior to that, we really had not done much at all in numerous years. But our auto line of business, we were falling short given the number of record insolvencies that we were seeing come in. So we looked at several different amounts that we needed to assess the industry, and we landed on $55 million. This was assessed against the 405 member companies. At our last board meeting in December, we had not collected all of that $55 million. There was still $14 million outstanding in that. John, through some tireless work on himself and his team, we have now collected 100% of the $55 million. So we are in good shape there from making sure that we're able to pay these claims, and just really, honestly, very happy that we were able to collect all of it. Okay. All right. Historical, just if you're interested, item B. So if you go to the attachment there, I briefly mentioned this just a moment ago. It does go through the assessments. So we last one was the administrative assessment and then the auto assessment. And that's all we've had in over 10 years of the industry. We really try hard not to have to assess the industry. We don't want to be seen as having too much within our coffers. It's a very delicate balance, but we also have to have enough that we ourselves are solvent and able to pay these claims. So go to attachment C. This is just a historical overview of the distributions and recovery.
Tiffany, this is Mike. Can I interject something, especially since absolutely, we have new board members, to your point about perception or reality that we may have too much reserves on hand. That sometimes becomes an issue during a legislative session because obviously companies get premium tax credits when they are assessed. So there is some thought, depending on who you talk to, that the excess money could be the state's money. And we get into some of those kind of scrutiny sometimes. So I think your point is well taken. We have to be prudent and diligent and make sure we have what we believe is adequate, but probably no more than that.
Hey, Mike, this is Steve Flynn. Is there a established reserve policy as such?
I'll let John or...
Yeah.
I think we have something established, but the way someone looks at it may not agree with what we've established, is what I'm trying to say. But,
hey, Steve, I'll let Annette speak to it. The monies that we have on hand are based on the reserves we have for the claims that we receive. A number of years ago, to Mike's point, we had an actuarial study done. Chair Joe Betsy and myself got invited to meet with the commissioner concerning assessments because it's always a highlight. And she suggested that we do an actuarial study. We had that done. And the reserves that we had on hand came very close to what the actuarial projections were. So when we get these insolvent estates in, after Annette has her staff review them, they set the reserves because the reserves are never right on insolvent companies. That's why they're insolvent. You might get a workers' comp in with catastrophic type claims to it. And in order to save money, a catastrophic claim might be at $10,000, which is ridiculous. We have to set proper reserves with that. But I'll let Annette explain that.
So yeah, the actuarial study went a long way towards workers' comp because under the new law, that claim can be open forever. So you don't have to consider medical and indemnity and you know, it's like be on prosthetics that needs to be replaced every few years. So that went a long way towards getting some true reserve picture for workers' comp. The other one is a little bit more difficult because we never know what we're going to get in. I could get up today and go sit down at my desk and get another insolvency that you know we'd have to change reserves for. So what we already have on hand may or may not be sufficient. So that's one reason why I don't go down too far on them. The one that we got, the AMCAP that I mentioned before, I've paid as much as $2.5 million on one to one insured, and we wouldn't have done that, you know, prior on the substandard auto reserve liquidations that we've gotten. So we look at everyone as we get them. We set reserves on anything other than workers' comp, and then we look at them again every 90 days. To change them, to make sure we're trying to keep up with what's true and actual reserves on the claim.
And Steve, just for your benefit, 90% of what we paid out over the 29 years has been workers' comp. We're handling claims for workers' comp from 20 years ago, TEIA, ECC, because they have lifetime payments for medical. If they reopen the case, we have to continue paying on that. So we don't get to step away from workers' comp insolvencies at all. We have them for the life.
And just to build on that too, you know, we talk a lot about all the internal controls that we have and what the auditors review. And there are certain internal controls that we look at annually, or they look at annually, excuse me, and put into their report. And one of those has to do with diarying, making sure that the diaries on particular claim, all claims certainly are up to date. And obviously that will influence claims. The worst thing that can happen for us is that we have that reserve set up at such a low limit, but we haven't updated the diary. And then suddenly we have a claim reserve set up for $30,000 and we're paying, you know, $500,000 or $300,000, excuse me. So that's that is something that we pride ourselves on, the auditors are reviewing as well.
I think it's also helpful, especially for the new members, to know why would the legislature be interested in how much money is reflected on TPCGA's balance sheet. And that's because, when an insolvency occurs, the staff has to estimate what are going to be the covered claim liabilities. And then they look at the existing money in the account of, if it's an auto insolvency, the auto account, if it's a workers' comp insolvency, the workers' comp account, or if it's anything else, the other insurer account. And to the extent we see there's going to be a shortfall, you have to do an assessment. The assessment is funded by member companies, but the law provides that the amount of their assessment can be used to, over time, reduce their premium taxes. So in effect, the industry is making interest-free loans to, you know, cover, to fund, to fund the covered claims. But in the end, it's reducing premium tax income to the state. So because there's that loss of tax revenue, this, I think, sometimes causes the legislative budget board or legislators to think, well, gosh, you're reducing our tax base, but so why do you have all this money in the account? And as others have said, there's money in this account because you don't pay certainly workers' comp claims all at once.
Can y'all hear me?
Over time, so you have to retain the reserve. Just a little color.
I think, Tiffany, we left off at cash flow, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
I lost everybody there again. And then when I direct messaged, it only went to Larry, apparently.
So, do you want us to go back over the discussion?
No, I heard most of it. But
we have a recording, so that's froze. Helpful.
Okay.
So I don't know what's going on. I don't normally have internet issues, so I'm kind of surprised. So we'll go to the five-year cash flow statement. And actually, I think at least what I heard of Shelby's last part there, that we do a projection 5 years every single quarter. This is part of our board packet. And this is something that we look at as we are deciding, hey, do we have enough money to pay these claims? Do we need to look at a potential assessment in a year, 2 years, et cetera? But we have six insolvencies that are listed there at the beginning in our overview letter that we are currently projecting out for paying those claims over the next 5 years, as well as we have $55 million that we just collected built into the five-year cash flow statement now. So if you can see there on the left, it shows it by line. So one of the things that we are not able to do within the organization is, you know, basically rob Peter to pay Paul. So we cannot take from the administrative bucket of funds to pay auto claims, for example. So as you're going through this, it's important that. Shoot. Can y'all hear me?
Now we can. Stop for a second.
Where did y'all lose me?
We can't rob from Peter to pay Paul.
I thought I heard you say you were finished. No, I know.
I'm done. So but basically what I was saying is it's just important to look at each one separately. You can't look at them in aggregate because we aren't allowed to take from auto to pay administrative or vice versa. Mm-hmm. So as you're going across there, you can see we've got that $55 million that's really boosting up our auto reserves right now. But as you go across the years, you can see what we've projected out to pay. We will pay out the majority of that $55 million that we are collecting. So, and that does not take into account, we could have further insolvencies coming in the future here. Right now, this takes into account the six insolvencies that we just had. So, okay. But no concerns right now on any of our lines or administrative bucket. I think we're in pretty good shape here. looking at the five-year projection. Again, that could change at any time, just given what happens within the industry. And I think it is important that right now in this inflationary market, if carriers are not able to react quickly enough, we could see insolvencies begin to heat up. Moving on to the next section here, which are the amendments to the 2022 operating budget. So Betsy did cover a little bit of this during the HR committee, but the one piece that we do want to just emphasize here is that we are moving two of these three items. One is the inflation item and the other is the employee benefits, as Betsy said earlier, out to our next board meeting. So they're not off the table, but again, we still have additional work that we need to do before anything's there. And then we just have the salary grid shift. So, Betsy, we don't actually have a copy of the salary grid shift in the book today because, it was late to the party. So how do you want to address this?
I thought we already voted on the salary grid shift.
Right.
Okay, but we don't need to do anything further for our budget purposes then?
Nope.
No.
Okay.
It doesn't influence the budget.
That's even better. All right. So I'm finished with that section. All right, moving on to auditing, Plant Moran. So we do have an annual financial statement audit that Plant Moran conducts for us. That audit, the on-site has been conducted at this point. We do not yet have a final draft of any findings yet from that. So we will start to get some of that in. Mo Salem, who is the contact point at Plant Moran, I usually do hear from her shortly after everything is concluded and we walk through that, but we are not at that point yet, but it is in process. Everything is going well. There is nothing to report. Okay. The next piece of this is the board has been discussing over the last couple board meetings, do we have any additional needs for auditing within the organization? So we did decide that we will do a periodic fraud audit. There had been one done in the past. It had just been several years since that last one. So we did decide that in kind of a 3 to 5 year cycle, we would do this. So we did engage to have this done this year. Michelle McDermott, who is our contact for this audit, has been going through this. There is, again, on this one, we're in process. There is no draft report yet available or findings yet to report, but everything is on track and is proceeding well. Okay. The last piece is we have a risk-focused examination. So this is TDI. They come in not very often, honestly, just to do an exam. For the 5 years that ended in 2020. So this is going back about 14 months. They're auditing everything up through December 31st of 2020. This had been postponed and et cetera, but it did commence in early 2022. And we did approve changing our operating budget to include an anticipated cost for this audit at approximately $40,000. So right now we are, I would consider it kind of early to, early mid stage of this audit. We have not at this point in time heard anything back on it. So we will wait until, additional work is done in this area as well. We're very early in the year for all three of these audits that I've mentioned. There will be a status update at the next quarter that will be more robust, especially on the ones from Plant Moran. And then this audit here, the NAIC audit, we'll just have to kind of go. There hasn't been one in so long that from a timeline perspective, and this will be proceeding for a while. So,
Tiffany, can I just add there on the TDI front, please? Again, yes, the examinations at the infancy stage. As far as a budget for that, the cost of that examination, TDI doesn't provide us with an estimate. So we're getting ongoing bills. We put an estimate together. I can't say if that, that budget is adequate or not, but as we start to get bills in, we'll report back to the board with where we are. We might need an amendment to that, but we'll keep you apprised.
And Tiffany, just for benefit, they do this every 5 years with us because of the type of organization that we are. And the last one was done 5 years ago, and they said they would come back in 5 years. So after this one is completed, 5 years from now, they'll start up the next audit.
Yeah, I think, hasn't it been a little over five because it got postponed?
They postponed it. Well, they put us on notice, but because of all the COVID stuff, it kind of went past their normal period of time. Plus, they have all new individuals that are doing these audits. And I think Joe Betsy and Michael remember Wheeler, who was the chief examiner, was the person on the front end of the audits in the past. He's long retired. So this is a whole new staff of TDI personnel.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Moving on to the next item, number 8, which is our Northern Trust Fund Strategy Report. I'm going to turn it over to John to cover that.
Sure. Sure. So let's see, if you all want to follow along, the best place to be is where we are on line right now. Just some of the high points in summary, but I'll direct you to attachment E if you want to look at the full quarterly report. We do use two money managers, as we all know. We use Royal Bank of Canada, RBC, and Hayden Regal. They're about half and half as far as the mix of investments that they manage on our behalf. They adhere to our very, very conservative investment policy. To that end, we all know that we are in a situation where interest rates are certainly starting to rise, but we're in an environment of low interest rates. So we don't have significant income that's derived from the portfolio. Our goal is to preserve the portfolio to the best degree possible. In essence, that's why we have such a conservative investment policy. We do, based on the mix of investments that we have, if we go to that page, is great. Okay. If we go to the, based on our investment policy, we butt ourselves up against various benchmarks. We've effectively exceeded those benchmarks, except for, you'll see in Q4, PNR, Payton and Regal slightly missed a benchmark, nothing of a heartburn nature, so to speak. As we move on with regard to the durations of our investments, they average under 4 years of duration. So to that end, when those investments or those bonds mature, we'll go out to the marketplace. And just by virtue of interest rates increasing, we're going to be positioned to earn more investment or interest income in that way, simply based on the market. Tiffany and I have had some discussions. I've done some exploration with regard to other options, perhaps to enhance our return in the portfolio. That would certainly involve making some modifications to the investment policy, but there are some things we could consider. I think that given the environment that we're in right now with interest rates increasing, that we likely don't need to pursue that avenue because by default we'll get there, but nothing else of strong consequence here. I do know that at our committee meeting, Larry Bruning did have some questions with regard to investments, and you'll see in tabs E1 and E2 some references based on bonds that have inflationary components to it. We don't really have any area of risk there, but certainly a good question. We'll stay on the pulse of that. Any questions on that strategy report? Great, thank you. Do you want me to round it out, Tiffany, or do you want to take the fluctuation stuff?
Excellent. Bring us home here.
Okay. Well, I can bring you home real quick on this one because because we've got a delay. You know, we put the last quarter material in the book, and I believe actually that the current board members did get access to the last set of financial statements that came on through. So we've got our fluctuations there that we work through on a quarterly basis. This is the full year. Bottom line, our 21 budget, we came out favorable, 1.1% under budget, which was great. There were some peaks and valleys, but effectively we came out under budget. You'll also see that we break those out by employment expense and administrative expense. The net is 1.1% benefit. We did have a bit of an overage in admin expenses, but we did fine. You'll see on page 7 there, item 2, Tiffany did just reference today that, you know, we talked about our increase, but given the fact that we did have to trigger that policy, our increase is not nearly the 38% industry average that she's referenced there. And all in all, everything has looped out fairly fine there. So any questions on financials and 21 budget? Thank you.
And I think that is it for the Finance and Audit Committee report today. So Mike, I'm done.
Good job.
Okay, are there any more questions or discussion on Finance and Audit Committee issues? All right, then.
Norton, are you going to cover the counter signature issue or just defer that?
No, I think Tiffany's, we're just going to postpone that until the June meeting.
Yeah. Okay.
So we will. The time is now about 10:44 a.m. and the board will take about a 10-minute break and then adjourn into a closed board and council only executive session to consult with the general counsel to receive legal advice on issues arising out of the Texas Open Meetings Act, the litigation report, and any agenda items as authorized by Section 551.071 of the Texas Government Code, and to discuss a confidential personnel matter as authorized by Section 551.074 of the Texas Government Code. While we're on break, I will be sending a Zoom invitation to the board members and general counsel, and I will see y'all back here in about 10 minutes.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks. Started, Ben.
Okay. We are up and recording. We're ready to go.
All right, thanks. Okay, the time is now 11:20 and the board has concluded its executive session, the board only with council executive session, and we're back in the open session. And at this time, the chair will entertain a motion to direct the HR committee to initiate and administer the process to find and recommend to the board a successor for the executive director who plans to retire at the end of the year.
This is David Nardecki. I'll make that motion.
Okay, the motion's made by David Nardecki. Is there a second?
This is Tiffany. I'll second it.
Tiffany seconds the motion. Are there, back in the dark, are there any questions or any discussion? Hearing none, the motion passes unanimously. The next item on the agenda is the public comment. And since there are no members of the public here at TPSIGA headquarters, there is no public comment. And the last item on the agenda is just announcements and adjournment. The next board meeting is scheduled to be an in-person board meeting on June 15th, 2022. Does anyone else have any announcements or comments to make
at this point? Well, hearing none, I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
I move to adjourn.
Tiffany Reiner moves. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
David Nardecchia seconds. Any questions, any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any abstentions or objections? Hearing none, the motion carries unanimously. And at 10:22, we stand adjourned.
11:22.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Excuse me, 11:22.
11:22, okay.
11:22, we stand adjourned.
All right, thanks, everyone. Thank you. See you in June in person.